Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.
And welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Zach Morgan. I'm co-host of Pop Health Podcast. I am joined this morning in sunny but brisk San Francisco, California by my co-host Gavin Ward. Gavin, good morning.
Good morning, Zach. I'm glad I brought my fleece. I'm wearing a t-shirt today and usually just wear a t-shirt, so really glad I brought the fleece.
Yeah, and we've had a couple of episodes apart from co-hosting, so it's nice to have you back.
Thanks, Zach.
Looking forward to this episode. Yeah. I'm also really looking forward to this episode because we have a special guest with us today, Dr. Ashby Wolf. She is the Chief Medical Officer for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services in Region 9. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, before we get too far ahead, what is Region 9?
So Region 9 is part of the Western division of how CMS actually splits up its implementation of policy. So Region 9 includes California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and the Pacific territories of American Samoa, Guam, and the Northern Mariana Islands.
Wow.
So it includes about 20 million Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries and a wide variety of cultures, a wide variety of languages spoken, a lot of different geographies in terms of how clinicians practice medicine. So it's a really fantastic and interesting place to be serving.
Yeah, and obviously this podcast will be all in English, but you might catch Dr. Wolf presenting in Spanish at some point. So again, thank you for being here. Also, you're an actively practicing family physician as well. Is that right?
That's right. I have a practice at a community health center in Oakland just across the bay. And so as part of my duties as chief medical officer, I also continue to see patients on a weekly basis, which I think is really important. Yeah. In this position.
Nice. Because I'm sure that this position doesn't keep you busy enough that, you know, got to tack on some extra hours.
So. We have our hands full. That's true.
I was going to ask, do you, the patients that you see know your other role here at Medicare or CMS?
Actually, not that often. Yeah. I have a couple of patients who enjoy the policy wonk space. And so they often will ask me questions about what's happening with the Affordable Care Act or other things like that. But not too many people actually are aware of the other hat that I wear in my practice.
Nice. Now, I know today we're talking about a few things. Zach, we have, we're talking a little bit about MACRA a little bit later on. Yep. On the episode. And what else we have on tap here?
So we're going to talk about some of the new long-term care facility regulations that are happening. Before we jump in, do want to point out, we're not going to jump into the political changes and things like that. I know that people see interview with CMS. I think that's a conversation for another day. We're going to talk about some things that are concrete and happening right now. But before we dive into all of that, for our listeners, what is something that they might not know about you, hobbies or activities outside of work, if you have any free time?
I have some precious free time. Yes, it's true. I actually really enjoy the outdoors. And so last year I started learning how to sail. I was inspired by the America's Cup team back when they were racing here in the Bay in 2013. And so have gotten my sailor's basic certification, which I'm really excited about and hoping to go further with that, you know, when the weather gets a little warmer.
Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, when we had first met you, actually, you were speaking at a conference, and you were speaking specifically on CJR. Before we dive into some of the other things, obviously, this has been a big impact on people. Are there any kind of updates, or how is the CJR program going from your perspective, and kind of a big picture perspective?
Yeah, so for those of you who are listening who may not know what CJR is, there are a lot of innovations right now going on at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We're testing a wide variety of different payment strategies, what we call alternative payment models. These strategies influence the entire health system, including the private sector, and have wide bipartisan support. Broadly speaking, these alternative ways of paying for care fall into three categories. There are population-based payment models, such as primary care medical homes, There are episode-based payment models or bundled payment programs, which include CJR, which is the Comprehensive Joint Replacement Bundle Program. And then there are other models of payment focused around specific types of clinicians or specific types of patients. And what's really interesting is that CMS has been involved in a national effort really to help build momentum around the health system's adoption of effective alternative payment models. Already, we have commercial health plans, as well as Medicare and Medicaid, and different states representing almost 200 million of the nation's covered lives, with about 23% to 25% of their healthcare spending flowing through these alternative payment models. So again, we're really moving away from simply paying for each service that is provided and actually paying to encourage coordination of care and integration of care for those patients, regardless of where they're actually seeking care in whatever facility. Sure. Now, the CJR bundle, or the Comprehensive Joint Replacement bundle, is again one of these innovations that we're testing in a variety of locations across the country. Several hospitals within Region 9 in California and Nevada are actually involved in this, where the CJR model is really aiming to support more efficient and high-quality care for patients who are undergoing the most common kinds of inpatient surgeries for Medicare beneficiaries, which are actually hip and knee replacements. This model actually started in April of 2016, so it's really only about 7 months old, in the sense that hospitals and post-acute care facilities are becoming more familiar with how to work together as they care for a patient who comes in for the surgery, stays in the hospital for a brief period of time, and then needs post-acute care such as physical therapy, nutrition, etc. And so over a period of time, we're looking forward to learning what hospitals and nursing facilities are experiencing in terms of lessons learned to coordinate that care and to continue to providing high quality care, again, regardless of whether the patient is in the hospital or in the nursing facility. And right now we have about 800 hospitals participating in the CJR model across the country. So,
and if the listeners would like any more information, if you haven't yet listened to our Pop Health podcast episode with Ruth Zaltzman, she dove into kind of the difference between the different bundled payments and what they mean, and some further explanation there.
Sounds good. I know there's been some other things happening, specifically with innovations and some of the successes. Dr. Wolf, would you mind talking about some of the other work, maybe some of the successes you've seen over the past year?
Certainly. Specifically with respect to the bundled payments, there is another bundled payment model known as BPCI, which we just released our first evaluation of that program. And actually just yesterday, November 17th, our acting deputy administrator, Dr. Patrick Conway, released a blog highlighting some of these results. And there is a specific link to our article that was published in JAMA around the lessons learned, and specifically around the voluntary bundled payment for care initiative program.
Dr. Wolf, if you mind me asking, I know some folks out there may not know what JAMA is. Can you tell the audience what JAMA is for those that don't know?
Sure. JAMA is one of the current premier journals where a lot of different information gets published and research is published. The Journal for the American Medical Association is what JAMA stands for. So if you're interested in taking a look at some of the information we have currently available on what it looks like to bundle payments for joint replacement, you can actually find this article. It was actually published in September 27th in JAMA. You can certainly Google it, but you can also take a look at cms.gov and review the blog that Dr. Patrick Conway has written. You can actually find it by going straight to our Innovation Center website, which is innovation.cms.gov. And again, that blog was published yesterday, November 17th, and it talks about some of the lessons learned from a variety of payment strategies and alternative payment models, and also specifically references the bundled payment program.
Awesome. Very good. And before we get into macro, I had one other question about how CMS is looking at social supports as well. I know we have California Department of Social Services, but we see a lot of social supports, a lot of social issues that actually are causing some health issues. So tell us about how CMS is looking more at the social part of healthcare.
CMS definitely has participated in a number of conversations this year and in 2015, looking specifically at our beneficiaries who are the most vulnerable and looking critically at reasons behind why a patient may be readmitted to the hospital or may not be able to adhere to care recommendations. And a lot of times, the reasons behind why a patient is experiencing more complex care consequences is because they have a specific health-related social need. So in earlier this year, in 2016, CMS announced an opportunity for communities, including but not limited to clinicians, communities to participate in another innovation center model known as the Accountable Health Communities model. This is a model that is testing specifically the question of whether or not we can improve the quality of care and decrease the cost for Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries if we directly address health-related social needs. And of course, this includes food insecurity, where someone may not have access to healthy fruits and vegetables and healthy foods. It includes transportation insecurity, where someone may not be able to actually follow up in their medical appointments because they simply don't have transportation or easy-to-use accessible transportation. It also includes things like housing insecurity, where many of our patients, for one reason or another, do not have consistent, safe places to live. And of course, additional health-related social needs can include things like interpersonal violence or other relationship-based issues. So the Accountable Health Communities model is designed to encourage communities, both clinically focused organizations and non-clinical organizations, to actually work together to screen people when they come in and seek care from a clinician. They'll be asked a series of specific questions to identify whether or not they have a health-related social need. And in working together with the community, the hope is that we can get the Medicare or the Medicaid beneficiary access to the services to address their need and as well help to address the clinical issues that are at hand. So we just finished our application period and are now in the process of reviewing applications, hoping to award specifically the grants and start the program in 2017.
Very good. I know the Innovation Center over the years has been willing to commit funding and significant funding to really change healthcare, and it's pretty neat to be in a country that does that.
There's a lot of exciting activity going on right now in the Innovation Center, and specifically with the Accountable Health Communities grants. Each organization that's successful or each community that's successful will receive $1.17 million per year for every year of this five-year model. Wow. So there will be definitely some things to watch for as this model gets up and running.
Awesome.
Just one of many changes and new ideas that are happening all around us right now in the healthcare community in general. But I think that's kind of a good leeway into kind of one of the main reasons that we're here to talk with you today. So just recently, there was the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act. It's an important piece of legislation. Obviously, many people that are listening may have been directly affected by it, although I think some people may be affected by it and not even realize that they're being affected by it. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act, also known as MACRA, which is the more popular acronym, was passed in 2015 with large bipartisan support. It passed overwhelmingly in the Senate and in the House of Representatives and was signed by President Obama in April of 2015. MACRA is a law that specifically does away with and gets rid of an archaic way of reimbursing clinicians under Medicare. Specifically, what was known as the sustainable growth rate formula, which was used to potentially calculate reimbursement cuts to physicians over a period of time, was always a subject of consternation and challenge for clinicians who could never really anticipate what their reimbursement would look like from year to year. So the MACRA law gets rid of that old way of calculating reimbursement and instead establishes a new framework to pay clinicians for providing high quality of care and for coordinating care with their colleagues across the healthcare spectrum. In addition, MACRA does a couple of other important things. It reauthorized the Child Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, funding it for another 2 years. CHIP covers more than 8 million children, many of whom would otherwise be uninsured, and so the MACRA law actually sustained this program for another 2 years. And then it also allows CMS to do a significant significant amount of streamlining of its existing quality reporting programs. Many clinicians right now are sending in data about the quality of care they're providing to a number of different payers, both Medicare and commercial health payers, who all have their own reporting programs and requirements for what data needs to go where. It's terribly burdensome. It's really difficult for clinicians to actually do this work consistently. And so part of what MACRA allows CMS to do is to decrease administrative burden in its own reporting programs and work with commercial health payers to actually align across systems. So there are a couple of really important changes that CMS is working on right now to meet the requirements of the law.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I think that especially in our scope, both for this podcast and just kind of in the general area we work, so much is on the aging population. So to have a specific part that extends the children's health insurance as well is an interesting aspect to it. With MACRA, how does it change the payments for physicians?
Yes. So MACRA authorizes a series of stable updates to the Medicare physician fee schedule. So every year, including 2016, there is a 0.5% update to the physician fee schedule, which of course it dictates how Medicare will reimburse clinicians for a variety of services that are provided to patients. But in addition, MACRA authorizes what is known as the Quality Payment Program, which fundamentally streamlines how Medicare is paying clinicians for providing services to patients who have Medicare Part B, which of course is the fee-for-service side of Medicare, where patients are often seeking care in an outpatient setting. Many clinicians bill Medicare Part B, and they work in a variety of different facilities, including hospitals, post-acute care facilities, as well as ambulatory clinics and surgery centers.
Sure. And also an incentive for physicians to get involved in some of the alternative payment models that that we had talked about before, which is an interesting way, because sometimes it's fragmented between, say, the health system and the physician and aligning of goals. And so it's interesting to see that there's some of the emphasis put on it joining those alternative payment models as well.
Yes, Congress, in writing the MACRA law, Congress really indicated that they would like more of Medicare payments to move away from the typical fee-for-service payments, again, simply paying for volumes of care that's provided, and really moving towards more Medicare reimbursement being provided in alternative payment model structures. So what this new quality payment program is it essentially keeps and maintains a lot of the systems where we currently report data to CMS, but we have decreased the amount of data that clinicians must report. We've also built in more flexibility so that clinicians can send in data to CMS in a way that reflects actually the scope of their practice,
right,
rather than simply clicking boxes or checking off boxes saying that they have done X, Y, and Z, which may or may not actually be relevant to the kind of care they're providing their patients.
Right.
And then what essentially the quality payment program is it is an opportunity for clinicians to get paid for providing high quality care. Traditionally, there are many different reporting programs in Medicare, one of which is the Physician Quality Reporting System, or PQRS, another of which is Medicare Meaningful Use. These programs have had their own separate sets of data and their own separate sets of expectations, and of course, their own separate ways of adjusting payments upward or downward for clinicians. Again, the MACRA law is getting rid of those programs and sunsetting the expectations for those programs, such that all data related to the use of electronic medical records and quality of care measurement will actually now be reported under one system, which is the Quality Payment Program. For clinicians who are participating in alternative payment models like accountable care organizations, the Next Generation ACO model, Medicare Shared Savings Program Tracks 2 and 3, and the Oncology Care Model, those clinicians will actually be able to simply continue practicing and seeing their patients under that model. They're already doing quality reporting, and they're already using electronic medical records as part of that alternative payment model. If they continue to do so, and they continue to see a significant number of patients through that model, they will actually be able to earn a bonus payment from Medicare every year, beginning in 2019, based on continuing to do that work and pushing value-based payment policy forward. For clinicians who aren't participating in alternative payment models, there are opportunities to get involved over the course of the next several years. But in the meantime, beginning in 2017, clinicians who bill Medicare Part B will be expected to send in quality of care data as well as information about how they're using their electronic medical record through the quality payment program. And then based on their performance, they also have the opportunity to earn a bonus payment or a positive payment adjustment in 2019.
Excellent. So there's a lot in there that especially physicians are it can be a huge change for them unless they've already decided to get involved in the alternative payment models. I think we understand, and probably most of our audience understands exactly what some of these changes are going to mean. For those that might not, what does this mean for patients?
So this is a great question, and it's part of the challenge that not only Medicare and Medicaid, but also other commercial health payers are facing. We are hearing from patients that they want information about the quality of care that different doctors and different systems will offer. We're also hearing from commercial health payers that they want to pay doctors for providing quality of care and meeting outcomes that matter to patients. So there's a significant need for information about what care patients can receive from the health system.
Right.
So we are working very carefully to build the quality payment program in a way that honors the work that our clinicians are doing with our patients and also paying clinicians for outcomes that matter to patients.
Right.
There are a lot of different moving parts to this program, but I think what's important for clinicians to remember is that the structures for reporting data to CMS are actually not changing. So if you've already been participating in either Medicare Meaningful Use or the Physician Quality Reporting System, PQRS, you can continue to submit data to CMS based on your previous experience. It's just that you have more flexibility to pick quality measures that actually matter to
sure.
you and your patients.
Sure.
We have specific information available on our Quality Payment Program website related to what exactly are these changes that are happening and whether or not you actually need to make any adjustments in preparation for the start of the program in January of 2017. That website is qpp.cms.gov. And of course, if you simply Google quality payment program, you will find that website as well.
Yeah.
On the website, we have several fact sheets related to both the clinician and the patient experience. We just rolled out an update to the website yesterday, and so there is additional specific information about what clinicians need to do, how they can participate, and the different options for participating. And of course, we're also running a series of webinars, both myself and my team out of the Region 9 office, as well as nationally. And there's information about those recorded webinars and additional information specifically for solo, small practice, and community clinicians.
Excellent. I know one of the things that this is just a little bit of a tangent off what you were saying. One of the things that we've heard a little bit is with the outcomes being made, you know, the most important, or with value-based care, things like a physician being able to, there's not a specific billing code for time spent maybe making phone calls for people who aren't doing a specific visit or different things like that. So it's encouraging to hear that there are changes being made that emphasize the outcome rather than the specific billing codes or visits within the office. I would imagine that there will be some significant changes, hopefully, that come from that. So,
yes, you're right. We're learning a lot, and CMS is doing quite a bit of our own internal culture change to address the fact that every clinician is interacting with their patient in a way that goes much beyond the typical face-to-face visit in an exam room or a hospital room. And part of what's interesting about the quality payment program and the change that it's bringing is clinicians are doing work where they're redesigning their day-to-day schedule to be able to accommodate patients who might have urgent care needs. They need to be seen that same day. You can't bill for that work.
Right.
You also can't bill necessarily for phoning up a patient or having your nurse phone up a patient to manage their questions related to medication changes, etc. But in the quality payment program, you actually get credit for doing that work as part of one of the categories of performance, which is known as the improvement activities category. So if you're trying to redesign your own practice workflow to accommodate patients' needs, if you're working with a care manager, if you're collaborating with a colleague across the town in order to coordinate care and further address a particular patient's significant care needs, all of that work is considered important and is valued by the quality payment program structure in a way that really hasn't been in the past.
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure that we get to the long-term facility changes and things like that. But just kind of before we jump off of that, well, there are a lot of big changes. Were the changes made in, you know, conjunction with physicians? You know, was there input taken from the health community? And obviously, it starts in 2017, which is here. So how is it going to launch? How can physicians be prepared to launch this so quickly?
Yes, this is a really important point to make. Ever since MACRA was passed, CMS has been hitting the ground running to get information from clinicians about their experience with existing CMS programs, which of course include PQRS and Medicare Meaningful Use. We have received over 4,000 public comments on the process of developing the quality payment program. We have also worked with a number of medical associations, patient advocacy groups, commercial groups, consumer advocacy groups, in order to understand what the current experience is like of a patient seeing a doctor and what the clinician's experience is like in meeting the existing regulatory requirements. Through that process, we've engaged over 100,000 people in developing the current quality payment program, which of course will continue to evolve as we learn more from our clinicians who are participating. The program does start in January of 2017, but clinicians do not have to be prepared to send in data on January 1st. There are actually multiple different ways that clinicians can participate based on what they feel prepared to do in the transition year, which is 2017. If clinicians have been actively participating in PQRS and Meaningful Use, and they want to report a full year's set of data under the quality payment program, they certainly can start reporting data through their registry or through their claims-based process or through the web interface based on their current performance starting on January 1st. But clinicians also have the opportunity to just test out the new program, especially if they've never participated in one of these programs before. They can simply pick one quality measure or one improvement activity and send in that data at any point in time between January and December 31st of 2017, and they'll be considered actively participating in the program. And so they will avoid any kind of negative payment adjustment or pay cut in the future for 2019.
Sounds like there's some flexibility there. Well, great discussion on MACRA, and you may hear my voice, everybody. A little sore throat today, so forgive me. This is Gavin speaking. We're going to switch topics here for the next couple of minutes and talk a little bit about some of the new regulations with long-term care facilities, which include, of course, skilled nursing facilities. Dr. Wolf, can you tell us a little bit about the intentions of these regulations?
Certainly. What's really interesting about the new long-term care regulations is that it is our first comprehensive update on long-term care facility regulations since 1991. This is important because there are now about 1.5 million Americans living in more than 15,000 skilled nursing facilities that are certified to receive Medicare and Medicaid funding. And with these changes that CMS finalized just last month, they're really intended to help both patients and clinicians by reducing unnecessary hospital readmissions, reducing facility infections, improving the quality of care, and of course strengthening the safety measures in place for our patients who are residing in long-term care facilities.
Okay, great. Tell us about the timing of these regulations.
So the rules have been developed over the course of, again, another long stakeholder engagement process where we had over 10,000 individuals and associations providing us information about not only what currently is happening in long-term care facilities, but the evidence that has developed over time around what it truly means to provide quality of care and to provide appropriate condition-specific care for patients, particularly those with dementia. dementia. So we have been reviewing the comments from the public before the final rule was put in place last month. And specifically, key changes are designed to improve patient safety specifically within the facilities, as well as to facilitate collaboration between the patients and their families.
Okay, good. We know there's a ton in the weeds of the regulations, but maybe share with us some of the highlights.
Sure. There are a couple of key changes, one of which is prohibiting facilities from requiring people to sign binding arbitration agreements as a condition of admission. This has definitely been an area of focus for a lot of patients and their families in their experience of care within long-term care facilities over the last. They'll still be able to use arbitration on a voluntary basis if a dispute arises, but any agreements would need to be clearly explained to residents, and we make those specific requirements in our regulation. We also are requiring facilities to take very seriously any particular allegations of abusive conduct, and we are also adding some specific instructions around how to provide effective and person-centered care that meets professional standards. There are some specific requirements related to facilities needing to update their infection prevention and control program, and this means, of course, that facilities will have to designate an infection prevention and control officer and create an antibiotic stewardship program that uses antibiotic protocols and a system to monitor the use of those antibiotics, especially as we start to see more resistant organisms appearing in different facilities across the country.
Okay, good. My grandmother was actually just in a inpatient and skilled nursing setting, and food is always a hot topic, and one of the reasons hospitals are on their surveys actually receive certain scores, both inpatient acute hospitals and skilled nursing. Tell us about any updates on nutrition or food.
Yes, this is an important additional part of our regulation where we're requiring facilities to provide each resident with a tasty, nourishing, well-balanced diet that meets their specific individual nutritional and special dietary needs. Facilities must take into consideration the preferences of each resident and must employ sufficient staff, including the designation of a director of food and nutrition service, staff who have the appropriate skills to carry out these functions of dietary services. And of course, the food and nutrition staff must continue to consider resident assessments and individual plans of care, including, of course, their clinical diagnoses in planning out these meals. So this is a specific direction and regulation that has not been in place in the past several years, and so represents really an important emphasis on nutrition specifically for our residents and facilities.
Well, very good. I know there's a ton more we can talk about. Dr. Wolf, you have given a wealth of information. I know you've shared some of the websites or parts of the website that folks should check out. So just to repeat as we close our episode of Pop Health Podcast, can you remind the audience where they can find information on quality payment programs?
Absolutely. Please feel free to visit qpp.cms.gov. That is the site where you will find information about the quality payment program, which is rolling out under the MACRA legislation, which is the most recent law that's affecting how clinicians are being paid under Medicare payment policy.
And can you also remind the audience what MACRA stands for?
MACRA is the newest law that is directing CMS Medicare reimbursement. It stands for the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act. And it is, again, essentially changing the way that Medicare is paying clinicians under Part B fee-for-service and encouraging clinicians to move into alternative payment models as the primary way of caring for patients.
And if you'd like to read a little bit more on the alternative payment models, innovation.cms.gov. I would imagine most of you are, if you're listening to this podcast, probably familiar with that website at this point. It was by Dr. Patrick Conway, correct? He wrote the blog. Feel free to check that out. Gavin, it's been a pleasure. Dr. Wolf, thank you so much for sitting down with us. As always, this has been another episode of Pop Health Podcast. You can find us on our website at pophealthpodcast.com or on iTunes, wherever you find your podcasts. You can also find me on Twitter at pophealthzac, Z-A-C, and Gavin on Twitter
at gavinpophealth.
There you go. We just like to make it challenging for you and switch it around a little bit to make sure you're paying attention. Again, Dr. Wolf, thanks for having us in this beautiful building in San Francisco, and thanks for listening, everyone.